It is. Brian Mazurowski and Joe Beamer.
Sure is.
Here on WBEN.
On a Friday.
Look at that.
A sunny Friday morning.
It wasn't always like this.
No, driving in was scary.
Right, I didn't hit any weather driving in.
No, but in the distance you could see the...
That's Lucas came in, he's like, I could see all the lightning coming down. And then when we started the show, you saw it rolling in. And it was like, wow.
It was pretty cool to see, you know, it was not getting stuck in the rain. It was pretty cool to see from a distance.
It's cool when you're not in it.
Yeah.
You can just watch it roll through.
The lightning in the clouds, but not actually having to be outside or driving in the elements, that was a really awesome wake up to the morning. I'm not going to lie.
Gone now, though. Sunshine, looking nice out there.
Beautiful.
And should be pretty nice the rest of the day. Got a lot to get to this morning, including our guest who's joining us on the line right now. As we've talked about this so many times before.
Yes.
But now, you know, as we've gone a couple of years into sports betting being legal here in New York, not just sports betting, but then mobile sports betting, what has the impact been? Well, the new book is called Losing Big, America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling. Its author, Jonathan Cohen, joins us live here on WBEN. Jonathan, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. No lightning down here in Connecticut. Thanks for asking.
That's good. That's good. It might be on the way. I don't know. It's rolled through here pretty quick. Well, listen, you wrote this new book, Losing Big. I want to know, what propelled you to take a look at sports betting and kind of the landscape as it's changed in the last 6 or 7 years?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it wasn't more than, you know, I'm a big sports fan, or was a big sports fan growing up, and I wrote a book about the state lottery system. So I had sort of developed an expertise in gambling policy, and it felt, I had the same sense probably that you did around 2022, 2023, that it sure seemed like something was changing. And it sure seemed like something weird was going on, and let's say potentially harmful. I didn't know at the time how harmful it was. So really with little more to go on than that, I thought, okay, there has to be a story here, and no one else, and this was true, this remains true, was sort of explaining exactly how we got here and where exactly here is with sort of the current sports betting setup.
You talked about, you know, getting here, and that's to where, you know, you can go to almost any state in the country and gamble on your phone. When did we start getting to that place where, you know, it's not driving down to the sports book or to the casino or across state lines, it's picking up your phone?
Right. So all this started thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court in 2018, which basically allowed states to legalize sports betting. And, you know, a couple states sort of rushed in, Delaware and New Jersey, you know, within the first couple weeks. But that was only retail. New York also, might remember, sort of had this period when you could only go in person in sports books, and then eventually it became on your phone. And now in most states, I think it's 30 plus states out of the 38 with legal sports betting, have a mobile component or let you bet online. And that is, as you're sort of alluding to, basically unprecedented and just completely brand new. And what is what I think sets this current sports betting apart from the legal gambling regimes that we've had in the past.
What are some of the stories that you heard from people in talking and writing this book that kind of shows the impact and how far some people have fallen into their phones, or maybe it is going to the sports book, fallen into sports gambling?
Yeah, I mean, I have two who I feature in the book, two stories of exactly that. And one is sort of a guy who was betting with a bookie, and then all of a sudden FanDuel becomes legal and he starts gambling with FanDuel. And so he was someone who sort of already was having trouble with gambling, and then legal online gambling made it worse. But there's this other guy I profile who's sort of the main character of the book. His name is Kyle. He's from Wichita, and he's the kind of person who, sort of to the last point, like, he would go to the casino every once in a while, he'd place a couple bets, but he never ever ran into trouble when it was in person. And the only time he ran into trouble, the only time he started gambling with his rent money, he started betting on minor league British darts at 3 a.m, was because it was available on his phone. And you've sort of captured it well. Like, the phone is already addictive, and now we put this, like, supercharged gambling, addictive gambling on the phone also. And that's why he was able to sort of run into trouble. He lost his job. He's sort of just now getting his footing back. But it totally basically destabilized him for in his mid-20s.
You talk about betting darts at 3 in the morning. You look at the games, you know, here in America, the major sports leagues, and it's not just the score you can bet on. I mean, it seems like you can, if you're watching baseball, you can lay a different bet down every all 9 innings.
Yeah, and more than every 9 innings, every 10 seconds, you can bet on the whether, like, for example, whether the next pitch will be 88 miles an hour or not. And this is not what was envisioned, right, in 2018 when this sort of became legal. And the idea is someone who's addicted to gambling, they're not actually addicted to winning, and they're not addicted to money. They're addicted to action. They're addicted to the uncertainty that comes with the bet. And so what you're doing by what these companies are doing by offering the chance to bet on whether the next pitch will be 88 miles an hour or who will score the next basket or whether the next play will be a run play resulting in more than 1.5 yards. Is turning sports gambling into a slot machine. You know, they don't want you to bet only place a bet on the game, watch the game, game's over. They want you to be betting over the course of the game and just constantly spinning, constantly pulling the wheel. And that's why they sort of offered these insane options are available at the start of the game, in the middle of the game, every single moment throughout the game.
So anytime we bring up this topic, I always keep coming back to this point, and that is that I feel like we had it perfect in about 2019 here in New York State, because that was the time, all right, they legalized sports betting. There's a casino downtown here in Buffalo that opened up a sports book. You could bet inside there, but it wasn't yet legal on your phone. And my thinking was like, all right, you know, betting on sports exists. We're not going to pretend. It always has, even when it wasn't legal. Now that there's the Supreme Court ruling, we're not really going to put the genie back in the bottle, probably. It's going to be out there. So let people do it. You have the freedom to do it. But it was like that perfect balance of it's available, but you have to go downtown and go to this one machine or this one teller and actually do it in person. You couldn't just do it, you know, from your nightstand before you turned off the light at night, or it wasn't that easy, or first thing in the morning when you woke up, no matter what day it was. Do you feel kind of the same way, or do you think that maybe it shouldn't have been legalized at all? Where are your feelings toward that?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a good framing. I do think it should be legal, and I totally agree with you that at this point the genie is out of the bottle, and I'm not one of those people who's claiming that they want to regulate sports betting but secretly wants to ban it. Like, I genuinely think it should be legal. I genuinely put money on the Celtics two nights ago. Like, I'm in on sports betting. I think it should be legal. I am inclined to agree with you, maybe not 100%, but almost, that the online setup, at least right now, is like a bit of a bridge too far. And maybe this is naive of me, but I like to think that we could put enough guardrails in place on the online that would make it safer. You know, getting rid of the minor league British darts, for example, getting rid of the ability to bet multiple mortgage payments in the course of 5 minutes. But I'm also willing to say, if more evidence emerges, for example, to say, you know what, the online is just not, it's not happening. It's just there are too many young people, especially young men, who are just overconfident, who are betting over their skis, and who just can't control themselves. And it's not their fault. It's because these apps are addictive, and we need to shut them down. And that you're right. We would need to return to this in-person component, which of course can have problems, and people have had gambling addictions at casinos. But if you want to bet, you can bet. And we've sort of filled. We're not you know, puritanical about gambling, but we're also keeping player safety in mind.
You talk about addictive behavior and how some of these gambling sites claim that they will stop you from overbetting, but in your findings, it's actually contrary to that, correct?
That's right. My findings are basically like what professional gamblers do. Professional gamblers who are sort of the quickest to get shut off by the companies, but the way that they keep their profiles going is by pretending to be addicted. Because they know or they suspect that the companies actually don't want to shut off addicted gamblers, people who lose money, because that's where the revenue comes from. You know, 3% of bettors account for as much as 80% of sportsbook revenue. So they want to keep losers on the app. Part of it is a problem of, if DraftKings were to cut you off, you're just going to go over to FanDuel. And then if you get FanDuel cuts you off, you're just going to go over to BetMGM or wherever. So there is no sort of incentive right now for the companies to behave better and to actually shut off and protect anyone who's addicted or who's betting more than they can afford.
It's interesting, you know, mimicking some of these addictive behaviors in order to stay on longer when you think it should work exactly the opposite. The one thing I can't...
I'm not good enough at betting that it's ever been a problem for me, but, you know, hopefully one day.
There you go. One thing I have trouble squaring away, and I'm wondering if you noticed anything in terms of government when it comes to the regulation and even really allowing this in the first place. I mean, is it just all about the money was just too much to pass up for these states when making the decision? Because here in New York, you know, our governor likes to say all the time, you know, our number one job is to keep you safe. And I mean, we've done everything. No, you can't have a flavored vape or a plastic bag or, you know, all these things that we've done here in the state to kind of, whether it's for the environment, for your personal health, for anything else, you know, the government's on it. And it's why it makes it so, like, incredible to me that this happened in the first place, because now here we're doing all this other stuff, but in this one case, all right, but you know what? If you want to bet your entire life savings on your phone on something trivial without any effort whatsoever, yeah, we'll let that happen. Like, that seems cool. You know, menthol cigarettes, you know, we'll just stick to other flavors, but, you know, the betting thing, whatever. I'm wondering if you talked to any people in government in the research of this book, and if it was just simply came down to dollars.
I got to say, it's the exact right question, and this is what animated my research on the lottery too. It was just preposterous to me that we had an agency of the government, you know, whose job it is to protect people's well-being, whose job it was to get gamblers and to get people to gamble more, and we have that exact same thing with the lottery, as we do, you know, now with sports betting. So my feature on this, and the lawmakers who I talk to are primarily in Colorado, which was sort of the focus of one of my chapters. And yeah, it really was that simple, as you said, of gambling has always been seen as free money. I'll put free in quotation marks, but it's money that, you know, for government that doesn't require tax revenue. The belief was, oh, so many people are betting anyway with their bookies, or betting anyway, you know, on these offshore illegal casinos, we're not even going to make anyone new. We're not going to make any new sports bettors. We're just going to take money already spent gambling and capture it for the state. That, of course, is complete BS. There's all sorts of people who never would have been, who are gambling now, who were not gambling before. But yeah, it's totally paradoxical that the state, whose job it is to protect people's well-being, should also overhear just try to make as much money from gambling as they can, regardless of the harm that gambling can do to people. And yeah, especially in New York, in particular, it was during the pandemic when sports betting was legalized, when the state really did have a fiscal crunch and really was looking for money wherever it could find it. And again, gambling has always been seen as this painless source of tax revenue.
Are there any states, or have there been any states, that have at least talked about maybe scaling back on this?
Scaling back might be too strong of a word, but I would say Massachusetts and Ohio are two states that have done the most to regulate it and to really think about how they want to, raise the floor. Right. You know, Florida is basically doing nothing to protect gamblers and has very, very few protections in place. And Massachusetts and Ohio, they're at least thinking about, okay, how do we, you know, for example, Massachusetts is the state that's leading on stopping sports books from cutting off winning players, to you know, which is really a, sort of a challenge to the core of these companies' business model. And they're at least doing the most to think about, okay, how do we balance this question of well-being with profit for the state and for the companies?
That question on how to move forward, I think it also plays into the question of, you know, when you have people who are really suffering because of a gambling addiction, who's at fault, right? And it kind of sounds like, in, you know, some of the way that we're talking, that it might be easy to blame the state that allowed this to happen. But at the end of the day, it is the person who chooses to make the bet. I know a lot of the bettors you've talked to in your book kind of say that, yeah, like, it is my responsibility. I'm the one who did this. Where do you think the responsibility lies? And is this, a public health problem, or is this a personal health problem?
Yeah. I mean, the right answer is always both, right? Like, the individual does bear some responsibility, no question. But in this case, I think the state and the company sort of also bear responsibility. Like, especially when we're talking about, like, young men, right? Like, someone who's exposed to a gambling ad when they're 16 during a Mets game, and then, you know, their prefrontal cortex isn't developed. Like, their brain isn't, like, even fully developed. And all of a sudden, they have an app on their phone that lets them bet $3,000 in 5 minutes. Or 30 seconds even. I think, yeah, the individual should bear some responsibility. And, you know, of course, parents should be careful and should talk to their kids about gambling. But we've sort of, I don't want to say set kids up to fail, but we've, like, set a bunch of landmines all over the ground around them. And then I'm not willing to blame them if they step on them. You know, I'm willing to sort of, like, say, yeah, you should be more careful when you're walking, but also the state and the companies that have sort of set out the landmines bear some responsibility. So to that part of your question, yes, I think I see it as a public health issue and a public health crisis, because it is not, to me, purely about individual failing. And it is about, we could have a system that better protected people, such that, yes, you still have some responsibility, and we're never, ever going to get rid of gambling addiction or get rid of people who are gambling more than they can afford. But we can prevent sort of these middle cases, right, of people who would have otherwise been able to control their betting, but for the fact that they bet on Malaysian women's doubles badminton at 3 a.m. because it's legal to do so on FanDuel. That is the kind of thing that I think we can regulate and we can fix, and we could make these people, let them have more personal responsibility by taking some of the more dangerous elements of the game out of sports betting.
Jonathan Cohen is the author of Losing Big. The other thing that's always amazing to me is how many people can be in so deep and have it be totally unknown to people close to them and keep it well hidden. And there is something to be said to that. And you mentioned young men, like, you know, there's a lot of things that you send Timmy off to college or whatever, and you know, you hope for the best. You hope you put a good head on their shoulders. You don't know, but you know, if they come home and their eyes are all red at the dinner table on Christmas break or so, you kind of might have an idea what's going on. If he lost, you know, $10,000 the other day, would you have an idea what's going on? It's amazing how well people can hide this and it can stay unknown.
Yeah, and this is honestly why I see it not just as a crisis, but sort of a public health crisis, in that for exactly this reason, gambling is the addiction with the highest connection to suicide, because people feel that if they, you know, run into issues gambling, and if they were to, you know, take their own life, for example, they would, you know, all their problems would disappear. And it's, you know, especially for these young men who, you know, might have other issues in their life too, or they might develop another addiction, you know, to drugs or alcohol to help them cope with their gambling problem. It's absolutely sort of an invisible addiction. And it's also it's so nefarious in that, you know, someone who's addicted to alcohol, they're not going to think, oh, if I just take one more shot, my alcoholism is going to go away. But someone who's addicted to gambling can say, oh, if I just hit this parlay, all my debts will be wiped out, and then I'll be free of my gambling addiction or of my problems from my gambling addiction. Lo and behold, it never, ever works that way, but that's what people think. And that's why, again, I don't want to sort of tell people what to do, and I think they should be able to free to make their own choices, but I at least want to sound the alarm or sound some warning about what we've unleashed and what its consequences would be.
Talking to the people in your book who have, you know, who have experienced addiction to gambling and have experienced close to losing it all, how do they get out of it? Because, you know, you mentioned the Mets, and, you know, I watch almost every Mets game, and three times a game they will do, hey, the live bet right now, and that'll come up, and I assume people who get addicted to gambling like sports as well and want to continue at least watching sports. How does that factor into, you know, trying to just rid yourself of this addiction?
Yeah, I mean, so the people I talk to, you know, the ones who got help and have gotten treatment, right, they literally hit, like, not literally, they hit rock bottom, right? They ran out of money. One guy sort of missed a couple mortgage payments and got caught. And that's sort of what starts the process. And to exactly your point, he, for the first year after you know, he started his recovery process, he couldn't watch Mets games live. He had to watch them on a delay because it was too tempting not just even the FanDuel ads or the sort of in-game promotions, but even just he loves the Mets so much and he wants to bet on them and he wants to bet on them to win. And knowing that the game had already been decided and that he actually couldn't place a bet on it was sort of what allowed him to maintain. So, yeah, I hope that, you know, someone who is in treatment and is in recovery from gambling addiction, right? I don't want to mean to suggest that every single ad or every single in-game promotion is like a potential trigger and they're going to like go off and bet because of that. But certainly we don't make it easy for someone who is in recovery or is trying to avoid gambling or is trying to stop gambling. There are these constant reminders of them, not just during the games, but even just on billboards or like on trash cans, like everywhere you go, to get them back in the game or to keep them in the game.
Jonathan, thank you for the time. Appreciate it. And good luck with your new book. The book's titled Losing Big, America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling. Jonathan Cohen, our guest this morning. It's 9:28. It is Brian Mazeroski and Joe Beamer on WBEN. If you missed our first segment, we were talking about sports gambling with the new book, Losing Big. And there's a couple things on this, Joe, like the one that he hits on in this book. That I'm, you know, here's what happens in the tabs. In the break, I close a bunch of tabs I don't think I'm going to need anymore, but then I'm like, oh, wait, I still.
That's why you print it out.
Yeah, you got everything printed out. I'm trying to be Mr. Green here.
I'm hoping corporate's not listening, but yeah, I knew I would close the tabs, so I made sure I just printed it out.
But in Losing Big, Jonathan Cohen writes in the book that it's different than. Because a lot of times people compare it, gambling addiction, and it's compared to tobacco or alcohol, these other things that are legal, even marijuana now, that you can possibly become addicted to, or they're not great for your health, but they're still legalized. And I love the distinction that he makes in the book, and that is that if you buy a cigar, you buy a bottle of whiskey, a pack of cigarettes, whatever. You are buying a thing. You're giving your money for a product that you said is worth my money. That's different than gambling, where they're playing almost a trick on your brain, where it's not you're not buying a product or giving your money for something that's, now you will hear people say, like, oh, I do it, it's fun, you know, whatever. But you're not, like, buying something that you say is worth your money. You know, you're giving your money for the promise of more money.
Right.
Like, that's what you're buying. Like, you're not giving them and they're giving you something back that you gain for this. They're just trying to almost trick you in a way to give your money under the premise that, oh, well, you'll turn this into a bunch more money.
And here's the problem with gambling. Now, like I've told you, when I go to Vegas, when I go to a casino, I bring cash. I never bring a credit card or any kind of debit card into the casino, right? Cash, money. And if I'm in Vegas, guess what? The rest of my money is in a safe in the room. I do not bring it. I don't bring any option to get more money. The problem with gambling is, no matter what you do, win or lose, what triggers in your brain? Oh, either I'll win more or... Mm-hmm. I'm going to win that back.
Yeah.
And the problem is when you're addicted, that's all your mind will do. It's never, that's enough. It's, oh, I'm going to get that back, no problem. Or, hey, I've doubled it. Let me triple it.
Well, I thought the book was interesting, and his perspective was because he, you know, as you heard there, if you were listening to the beginning of the show, he comes from that perspective of we're not going to just wind the clock back and ban it again. Like, it's kind of here to stay, but what's a different way to improve it or go on or change it a little bit so that it's just a little less maybe predatory or addictive, or you have a less of an ability to lose so much in such a short period of time?
I mean, I agree with what you said. I mean, you know, obviously self-responsibility is part of that. But I agree that certain sporting events, why is that even on the app? Here in New York State, you can't gamble on state colleges, right? Mm-hmm. You can't gamble on UB or on Syracuse, anything in state, Canisius, you can't bet in their games. Why, you know, maybe we take darts off. Maybe we take certain sports off the app. Maybe after a certain hour, you can't gamble.
It is funny. Like, there's things that are written in there. I totally understand that aspect of the law. Like, okay, you don't want college students to be betting on their own sporting event. It makes sense.
And that's almost every state, by the way. You can't gamble on in-state universities.
It's just, like, wild that, okay, like, we put one common sense thing in here.
Yeah.
Just anything else, whatever. You bet on anything else. Or, and again, like, I get the idea, like, oh, you can't bet on negative outcomes. Makes sense, right? Because that's, you're more likely to have somebody throw a game to do a negative outcome than, you know, it's harder to say, oh, this person won't score any goals or something like that, or won't do whatever, as opposed to, oh, I'll bet on myself to score a hat trick or something along those lines. I did want to bet on Jack Eichel to miss the playoffs right after we traded him, though. That was my one.
Yeah.
Wasn't allowed to do it.
I don't find you to have an addictive personality, though.
I can't. I am not a gambler. I just don't. It makes me... I will...
You don't know when to fold them? Or when to hold them?
No, no. I just... I don't like seeing my money fly out the door. Like, I don't have a ton of it. You work hard for what you have, and that's not how... If I do gamble, it is literally... Like, I remember having a conversation with somebody, like, oh, you play some money on the game, you know, right after it. I go, yeah, I put a dime on whatever. It's like, oh, a dime. What's that lingo for? I'm just like, no, literally, 10 cents. Like, I will put $3 into an account for a year.
Right.
And then just put, like, a dime. Like, that's how I'll do it.
Yeah.
If I do it.
Yeah, a dime. I can't lose my Aldi quarter. It's got to be the dime.
Right.
But, you know, the other thing these apps benefit from, and it's not just gambling apps, Brian. This is stuff that you buy on your phone. It's there is something, and I know that we live in a cashless society. You will spend more money when it's not cash. Give someone a card and give someone $100. There's $100 on a card, $100 cash. You have to keep this for a week. Who's more likely to actually have $100 at the end of the week?
Is that true? I love this. And 803-0930, if you have thoughts on this or anything else you've heard today, 803-0930, give us a call or a text on our Volkswagen of Orchard Park text board this morning. People say that all the time. For me, I feel like it's the opposite.
Really? I personally, for me, cash, I go through it a lot less quick. Because you see it. You literally see that money disappear. I think it's a lot different than taking a card or scanning your Apple Pay.
I understand it. I see why people say that. To me, it's like different because this might have been different, I don't know, however many years ago.
Yeah.
In my mind, like the cash, if I have cash on me, like, my money is whatever is in the bank account or in, you know, whatever different account. Like, that's my money. Like,
they're
that's my
money
savings. That's my stuff. That's my earning. Like, that's my stuff. And so when it comes time to, you know, move those numbers around, like, that's I get a little, like, I'm touching my numbers.
Yeah.
And I'm making it go down by sending it to this person or that person. Like, I don't like to do it that much. When I have cash in my pocket, that's outside of my money.
Interesting.
Do you know how, like, I notice it when I take it out of the ATM.
Yeah.
Right? When I get it. But if somebody pays me back in cash, this happens a lot. You know, whether it's a concert or something like that, you go to meet, you're out to dinner, whatever it is. You pay for whatever it is. Maybe you get an Airbnb together, whatever. You pay for it, you put it on your card, and then somebody pays you back in cash. That cash is never going back in my account.
Yeah, okay.
Are you the same way?
Well, I think it's less... There's more likely for it now because I can put cash in the ATM, and you couldn't do that 10 years ago. Do you know what I mean?
Can you?
Oh, yeah. My bank, you just go up, you put the cash in the ATM.
Oh, really?
Like, especially if you have to pay a bill. But I would say, more times than not, yes, that money sits in my pocket. And I will try to make that cash last as long as possible.
That, like, my money is the money in the account. Once it's cash in my, it's out of my account, I'm not going in to put it back in. I'm not turning this back into the digital number or whatever that's in there. So once it's in my pocket, it's like...
You treat it as extra money.
Yeah, that's kind of like, that's the mental game that it plays on me. If I have cash in my pocket, I'm, hey, I'll hand out tip and cash. Here you go. Like, give a fat tip out there. I'll spend it on stupid stuff. I'll whatever.
Yeah.
When it's cash, I'm more likely to do that.
See, when it's cash, I look at it as, okay, all those, like, you know, stuff you have to get through the week, dinner, groceries, all that stuff. How much of that can I do with this cash before touching the account that my bills come out of?
Mm. So all that stuff is just always paid in. You know, like, have you ever gone to and paid cash in one of the self checkouts?
Yes.
You have?
At Tops or Target, yeah.
I won't do it. To me, it's like, is this gonna take too much time?
See, for me, it's if the cash is on me, I'd rather spend the cash. And like you said, keep those numbers.
I do that, but not like grocery stores or things like that. I'm not spending the cash. Most usually because you hand somebody cash now in the year 2025, they look at you like you're from Mars.
But yeah, but that self-checkout, you're not handing it to anyone.
Yeah, but any place where you're going and seeing somebody, you hand them cash.
An example
of this.
It's
like the first time it's happened all day.
I had a $20 bill on me, right? And I had to go pick up some necessities for the house. And I wanted an energy drink. Yes, I know. I shouldn't be having them. Wanted an energy drink. I get there and I do the math in my head. I go, if I get this energy drink, I'm going to have to put it on my debit card. You know what? I'm going to save the $3 because I wanted to use this cash that was on me and not spend the money in the account. So that's a way of cash controlling my spending.
On our text board, 803-0930, someone's saying, all you need is a dime and a dream, Brian.
That's right.
That's what I... like, all right, at 10 cents.
Didn't you have an impressive... Didn't you change 10 cents into, like, $5 once? Didn't you do something impressive with a, like, 10-cent bet?
Yeah, keep it going, you know, little, and grow it into something. I mean, $5 isn't that impressive either.
From 10 cents?
Yeah, I guess.
You could buy a meal at McDonald's for $5.
Then you have people like, well, if you put $10...
That's the problem. That's what Jonathan's talking about in his book.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, it's the whole problem with the gambling issue. Someone else, Brian, you treat cash like walking around money. Yes. I'm not carrying a ton of cash on me usually. I'll $20. I know I said at the beginning of the year I'm going to carry $50 on me. Maybe that was last year.
It didn't work out?
No. But $20 I try to keep. Like, that's my walking around money. Once it's out of the bank, it's like, it's the world's. You once I have cash in my hand, you want to be the first one lined up to me. What can I do for you? Give me some of that money. And I'll probably be like, yeah, all right, let's go. Because I'll give you an example, like getting a haircut. Wait, if I have cash on me, go get a haircut right now. If I don't have cash on me, if I don't have that $20 and I have to go to the bank and take it out, well, maybe I can go another week.
I paid a month of rent by just taking extra cash and putting it in an envelope for a few months. And you know what that felt like? It felt like, oh my gosh, I got a month free rent.
There you go. Someone's saying I use cash 95% of the time because it's easier to see how fast it disappears. Look, I think most people think like you do.
Yeah.
And that's what you've always heard is that, you know, it's a mental thing. To me, it's just the mental thing works
the other
direction.
Yeah, which is great, because that's the direction society's heading in, if we like it or not.
Yeah, this person says, I'm against the cashless society, where the government sees everything you spend your money on. I do, look, I'm no conspiracy theorist, but I'm with you.
Yeah.
I'm with you. No more paying the babysitter or paperboy or money in a birthday card, etc. I also never use self-checkout to help keep jobs for people. I never understood that. You know, I'll go to keep the people employed. Like, the store is going to employ who it's going to employ.
Yeah, I mean,
you using the self checkout, I hate to break it to you, has no bearing whether or not.
I agree.
People, I agree. They're going to have one or maybe two people working a line. One of those people would have been is going to be doing something else, and they're probably going to have two less people working than they did before.
Remember. There was always a line at Express Cash Out. I remember working at Bed Bath & Beyond and going on my lunch break to the Wegmans on Dick Road. And there was always a line at the three lines that were open. And I'm like, oh my, I got 45 minutes here. I'm trying to buy self-checkout. Guess what? Those three lines were still open.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no line. There were the people that wanted to use the line, people that wanted to use the self-checkout. My point is, those people still had a job after the self-checkout. That was the point of the story.
I don't think it's going to do that much.
I do wish, and I love the Bisons and everything they do, and we've had Brad Bisping on a few times. I do wish the Bisons still took cash. Like, that to me is...
Oh, I hate cashless.
Yeah.
At the arena. I can't tell you how many times I pull up, go to one of the bars there, and got cash, and I was like, oh, wait. You don't accept this? What the heck? Like, I want it. I have it. I'm here to use it, right? Because it's my spending money.
Right.
Like, I don't want to give you my card, but here you go. I said when the Bisons did that, like, the Bisons a perfect opportunity. It's like the greatest place. Hey, here's $10. You go get an ice cream, get a hot tub, you know, whatever. Figure it out. Make sure you get your change. Like, try and figure it out. Can't do that anymore. I'm not giving my kid my credit card.
No.
Like, I'm not that crazy.
No.
I hate it. The digital everything. I saw somebody post about tickets again on how everything's digital. All the tickets are digital. No more ticket stubs. Ah, it annoys me. And then you know what annoys me more? When I got an email asking if I wanted to spend $25 for a commemorative ticket stub to a game where I spent $25 for the actual ticket. They want to charge me twice as much to get an actual, like a physical ticket stub to the game I already had admission to.
Speaking of that, I hope the Bills bring back the ticket sheets for season ticket holders for the final season. I think there should be a...
Don't hold your breath.
I don't want to buy a commemorative ticket for every game, but I would love to collect... the ticket stubs for the final season. But that's just me. And then, you know, they'll sit in a drawer and I'll never see them again. But I'd like to have that option. It's funny you mentioned the digital tickets. The Mets now have a program where for every digital ticket scanned, your Mets account gets 5 points. And it can lead to free popcorn or even free tickets or a meet and greet with Mr. and Mrs. Met. I can just meet them in the crowd.
Yeah. How many games do you have to go to get a free popcorn? You just bring your own popcorn. It's a ballpark.
If you're getting 5 points a game, the popcorn's 1,000 points.
Yeah, worth it. That was great. Look, you got David coming up next. Of course, the news with Lucas and Hardline on Sunday.
Hardline on Sunday will be joined by Minority Leader in the State Senate, Rob Ort. Also, I've been told the mayor's going to join me at 11. I'm hoping that's true. Mayor Chris Scanlon at 11. And, we'll have some other guests. Brian and I will be divorced for Monday and Tuesday and back together on Wednesday. He'll be here in the morning, 5 to 10. I will be in for Bowerly.
Separated,
yeah. Legally separated, back together on Wednesday at 9. But make sure you stay tuned. Lucas with the news. David next. I'll talk to you Sunday. Brian will talk to you Monday on WBEN.